same time, including WRCT.
To Public Affairs here at WRCT Pittsburgh. As usual, we'll listen to the news clips of the week as chosen by Rick Adams and myself, Kevin Amos. So sit back and take a listen and get caught up.
Greetings, Lumination. Happy Friday. I am Monique Presley. Welcome again to the Week with Monique. This time and space on the Don Lemon channel, where we pick that one thing. If we have to pick that one thing that you should pay attention to in the midst of all the news, all the noise, all the frankly mayhem that's going on in this country right now, here's the one thing that I'm asking you to highlight and pay attention to. If you don't know it, and if you can't tell by my blue, this month is Autism Awareness Acceptance Inclusion Month. This is the last official week, so the last Friday that I would have an opportunity to talk to you about that. And it's important every April and every other month of the year, certainly, but I am particularly wanting to highlight Autism Awareness Acceptance Inclusion this time because of statements, hideous, horrendous statements and planned actions that we're hearing about from the current administration and from the head of HHS. For those of you who don't know, autism is a neurological disorder that is marked by delay in speech and often marked by repetitive or idiopathic movements in younger children around the age of 2 is the earliest that there can be an official diagnosis. Right now, 1 in 31 children in the United States have been diagnosed with autism. It disproportionately affects boys more than girls, and we see it disproportionately affecting Black and Brown communities more than their white counterparts. 1 in 45 adults in the United States have autism, and it obviously is something that deserves attention, that deserves adequate research, and the children who are on the spectrum and their families deserve the best services they possibly can have, as well as the promise of this nation, a free and appropriate public education for each child, whether you learn differently or not. So that is the promise. And we are watching this administration tear that down by trying to gut the Department of Education, by trying to take funds away that go from the federal government to the states that are used for special needs programs, that are used in order for children who are growing into young adults to have the best chance to strive, to learn how to work, to have proper paraeducators and services. But to make matters worse, this week, RFK Jr., the head of HHS, said this.
This is an individual tragedy as well. Autism destroys families. More importantly, it destroys our greatest resource, which are our children. These are children who should not be suffering like this. These are kids who, many of them, were fully functional and regressed because of some environmental exposure into autism when they're 2 years old. And these are kids who will never pay taxes, they'll never hold a job, they'll never play baseball, they'll never write a poem, they'll never go out on a date. Many of them will never use a toilet unassisted. And we have to recognize we are doing this to our children, and we need to put an end to it.
Now, we're in the middle of Autism Awareness Month, and this man, who seems to have quite literally autism on the brain, chooses those comments. It's not just that it was dark. It's not just that it was dire. It's not just that it was wholly useless in terms of providing encouragement or support to families that are on the spectrum. It's that he was completely inaccurate. The things that he said, the assumptions that he made about the outlook for children and families on the spectrum, about whether they are a burden or not, about whether they work or not, whether they'll ever play sports or not, all of it was really just something that could be said about those with the most severe diagnosis. But what he ignores is that the vast percentage of those who are on the autism spectrum become productive members of community if they are given proper supports. I want to give you some numbers on that. First of all, diagnosis and early intervention matters. So when you're looking at Head Start programs, when you're looking at community programs, when you're looking at what the special education dollars do when they're sent to the states, if this HHS secretary and the Trump administration was really looking to do something about autism to decrease the numbers, do you think they'd be cutting those funds? Doubtful. But we also find that 74% of children on the autism spectrum graduate high school with a diploma, which is, yes, less than the 86% of all students, but only slightly. Not the children are never gonna graduate, children are never gonna, okay? Only 21% of people with diabilities generally are employed. However, nearly 60% of people with autism in the United States are employed after receiving vocational rehabilitation services. These are the services provided state by state to children and young adults on the autism spectrum that help them to explore possible careers, find a job, and secure needed accommodations in the workplace. 60% are employable, Mr. Secretary. Become employed. Become contributors to community. Pay taxes, since that's what you seem to care about. That's not the story that the head of the government services, the man who's in charge of Medicare, Medicaid, the CDC, the NIH, the one responsible for overseeing all of our health needs and concerns, he obviously has no clue what the current numbers are or what this community is actually about. It seems like perhaps he's never met a child on the spectrum like my own son. For those of you who may be new to following me here on Don Lemon's channel, but have been following me on my channel, Monique Presley channel, or following me other places, you know that I do advocacy year round for those who are on the autism spectrum and their families. Fight for legislation, fight for protections in education, because when my son, who is now 19, was almost 2 years old, we realized that he was on the autism spectrum and got a diagnosis for him. Unlike many parents who have to deal with this, I had a legal education, and so did his dad. We had means, we had family support. We were able to wrap our son with the best possible care to give the best possible outcomes right away. We started right away. Many families are not that fortunate. And so when they hear things like this from this administration, they become desperate. They become dire. We were told lots of things at the beginning of our autism journey. He may never speak. He may never ride a bike. He may never be able to hold his breath underwater. He will likely not enjoy social interaction. All false. My son, now reading on grade level, loving relationships with siblings, knows everybody's name at the school, enjoys conversing with his teachers, with his friends, participating in Best Buddies program, swimming laps in the pool. You really have to decide what report you're gonna believe. And I'm here to suggest to you, it better not be RFK Jr.'s, because he doesn't know what he's talking about, friends. So what can you do? You can share the information that you've seen on the screen. You can support organizations that are actively fighting to defend the rights of children with special needs generally, and those on the autism spectrum specifically. You can be a friend, you can be a family member of support and community. When you see somebody who's struggling, function with understanding, knowing that they may be in a hard space right now, but they won't be there always. You can share this information with your friend group, with your family group. You can be that helpful person in your community who maybe is paying attention and looking out for things in a young toddler that a family can't see for themselves because they're not getting adequate pediatric care the way that every family deserves, but often is not available in communities. Another thing that is under the direction of the current HHS secretary and the Trump administration. We can stand in the gap for each other. I know that there are stories that are different from mine, that children, you meet one child on the spectrum and you've met one child on the autism spectrum. They are all unique humans. They are all different. They all have different projected outcomes and they'll all have different realities. But here's the thing that's for sure. They are all spectacular humans deserving of every possible chance of success. They are not a burden. They are a gift and an opportunity for us all to be inclusive in the way that we think about others and think about ourselves. That's all I have for you today. Thanks for being here. Please subscribe to my channel, Monique Presley Channel. Please like this video. Please share it. Until next time, next Friday, 2 p.m. Eastern, stay safe out there.
Thanks, everyone, for watching.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media.
Welcome home,
y'all. We're here for this week's mini pod, and I'll just tell you guys, I was just telling Angela a story, but I didn't get a chance to get her opinion on it, so we're going to talk about that on the mini pod. Mm-hmm. So I'll tell y'all the story now. So I saw a black woman at the airport, mm-hmm. and we just started making small talk. And she obviously does well for herself, you know, and we were both in the like priority line and we're just chatting. And she starts talking about how challenging it's been in the private sector these days. And I was saying, yeah, there's been some really great writing, contextualizing, you know, how challenging it is. And she says, again, y'all, this is a black woman. She says, yeah, it's so frustrating. I just feel like people don't like when we make money. Like, they just get mad at people who work in corporate America who make money. And I am immediately offended at this entire sentiment. And thankfully, one of our other friends was there. I want to say who that is. I don't think she'll care. Joteka was there. Joteka Edie, who you guys know, leads Win with Black Women and is just a phenomenal person, a phenomenal singer, too, if you are lucky mm-hmm. enough to hear her sing. And so I am immediately like, you know, ready to attack, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, that's not true at all. People don't like when you make money on a system that's crushing them. I don't think people are just looking at you like I'm mad that you make money. But Joteka came in very softly, but directly, and contextualized it a lot better than I did, because I immediately felt like, I don't like this black woman because she sounds like them. Mm-hmm. And it felt like she moved like them. But what is a better way to deal? Because in my space, I'm like, I don't want to know you. You know, we're not the same. Mm. And I don't want to try to convince you. You know, because like you 50 something years old, you feel how you feel. But I just immediately I'm like, I don't like it. How do you think you would have handled it? What are your thoughts about all of it?
Sometimes I can be, I think, defensive and combative. And I think other times something is so mind blowing. I want to understand why. Mm-hmm. So I think I would have said, I mean, I like to believe I would have said, mm-hmm. can you tell me what you're talking about? Like, tell me what you mean by they don't want you to make money.
Yeah.
Just to unpack what she could have meant. I think that we're in an era right now where that type of fundamental misunderstanding is deadly. And I think we're seeing that across the board. I think there is like a, it's the, like the proletariat rising kind of vibes right now. And I'm puzzled by what she means, especially when the proletariat rising is the reason why maybe she got her bonus last year or the year before, because people saw her humanity and wanted to ensure that she was paid the same as everybody else. I think what isn't fair is the widening gap. The widening gap between incomes for folks who are at the, you know, entry-level jobs to the folks that sit in the C-suite. And I guess I would ask that sister, like, what do your parents do?
Yeah.
What did your grandparents do? You know, how would they feel about XYZ? Really just trying to understand it. Now she might come back and be like, well, I'm a fourth generation trust fund baby, or, you know, whatever.
She said after she caught the vibe, it feels like she tried to change it a little. She's like, well, I came from dirt to get this, which made me even more angry.
That's what I'm
like,
then
what the fuck are you talking about then? Like, were you mad at people making money? You know, like, how did you feel when you came from this dirt, you say, and you saw all the people around you making money on this system of capitalism that does not always serve us?
You know, Tiff, I'm going to tell you, I think that I'll just acknowledge this. I think that all of us are wired differently. We're like, it's truly that we're defined by our own experiences. There are some people who come from dirt who are like, I never want to experience that again. And I'm going to claw whatever and however, even if it means you, to stay in that, like, I'm going to sink my claws in this to make sure I never experience that again.
Yeah.
And we don't know who she's financially responsible for. Like, she might be feeling threatened in a way that's not rational. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it is. I don't know what her experience is at work. She might be getting reprimanded at work for being Black.
She's going through all of this because in the DEI space, like, she's had to change her job title. Just all of this. And I just couldn't believe she said that. But I'll tell you, it's making me think of something else that we got into last week.
What?
So many people commented on this and we didn't even talk about
what?
It. Girl, Gail. When I started talking about Gail and you were like, I love you, Gail. That's Tiffany throwing shade. A lot. And I just still feel this way. A lot of people are highly offended at her comments, which I am too.
What did she say?
When there was criticism around her going into space, and also her love for Jeff Bezos, people had a problem with that. And so it was all this criticism, very loud voices. And so she was doing an interview with somebody and she looks at the camera, is like, have you been to space? And then Black women lost their mind. They were like, what? And they were, people were filming all these responses to her. Like, no, I haven't been to space. I'm paying two mortgages. I'm taking care of kids. Or I'm, you know, and it does feel
Where was Mae Jameson in that moment to be like, actually, yes.
Well, but that was another thing, too, of calling herself an astronaut, you know, because she was like, I have so much trouble calling myself an astronaut. But I guess since I've been to space, it was like, right, you're not an astronaut.
You was a visitor.
Right, right. And so it does feel like sometimes that wealth can breed disconnect. I volunteer as tribute to get some wealth and show that I will not be disconnected.
Tiff said,
from the
if you get run her $1 million, she gonna sign a pledge and she gonna stay connected.
I really think I would give a lot of money away because it's hard for me. And to be honest with you, when you say when you come from nothing, part of me does feel that way, to be honest. I don't ever want to go back. I was born in Cleveland. Anytime I go to Cleveland, I could break out in hives. I'm sweating. Mm. I can't stand it. I get the memories of the time that I spent there. I always want to get, I had a speaking engagement there. I could not wait to leave. No diss to Cleveland, of course, and the people who live there. I have family there. But I just, those times, I don't like it. The State of the People tour is kicking off this weekend in Atlanta. And it's not a space for me to go and learn. You know, it's a space. It's like I'm revisiting a space of when I didn't have. Sometimes I don't want to revisit that space. And I'm panicked all the time that I'm going to retire. It is PTSD growing up without and Black, because I'm panicked all the time that at any point I'm going to be living that way again.
Yeah.
I always think, you'll appreciate this, having lived in D.C., I'm like, at some point, I feel like I'm going to wake up in a nightmare where I'm living out in Laurel on public assistance, you know, in a little 20-year-old vehicle that barely runs. Mm. And it is such a panic for me. So I am like that in some levels. Yeah. But I don't want my people in that space. That's I want right. to help my people as much as I can get out. And I feel so connected to my people who live like that. And I know how I felt having people come and talk and watching people on TV. I felt such a disconnect from those people.
But that's the thing too. I think that we sometimes are under the assumption that wealth is the only disconnector.
Yes.
You know, working in politics can be a disconnector.
For sure.
Working in media can be a disconnector. I think that we all have maybe a collective obligation. And if we had a call to action from the podcast, maybe it's finding other ways to connect with people who you feel like you don't have anything in common with, who are saying stuff that get on your nerves.
Yeah.
For me, people that, you know, I normally don't spend a lot of time with. And I think that is why I am so excited about the tour, because I don't crave disconnection. I actually really crave connection and knowing how to best advocate for my folks and also how to connect with my folks. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be disconnected. I think that's the
empathy.
Greatest insult. You know, sometimes yeah. I have it, sometimes I don't. You know, and it's not on purpose. I just, yeah. I'm like, either my patience is run thin or I'm like, how could you think that that's so dumb or yeah. whatever it is. But I don't want to be that way. I want to be able to lean and live into grace. And I think that the way to do that is through conscious connection.
Yeah.
So
I'm excited.
I am not an astronaut. I do love Gail. I hate that she did that. But you know what? I did feel a little empathy for her, right? When you were talking about, she was saying she loved Jeff Bezos. That's her friend, right? I guess. For me, I have some rich friends.
Jermaine struggled for years with dental issues before finally finding Nuvia. Listen to what he wanted most after his smile makeover.
I want to be able to smile at my wife.
And I don't want nobody talking about them.
But if
they're not trillionaires.
Yes. But if you're, I mean,
and all of my friends are rich. I do have some, and they have good hearts, and they do really good things.
Look, I'm her friend, and I ain't rich. So she.
I'm my friend, and I ain't rich.
Right, exactly. But I think if your friendship robs you of logic and facts,
yeah.
then it's hard to have a conversation about it.
Well, I am very illogical about y'all.
But I'm not even, if somebody comes to you and they're like, you know, I didn't like what Tiffany said and this is why, like, I don't expect you to be robbed of logic and facts, you know, moment you might say, well, just so you know, that's my girl. But I hear you. And thanks for sharing. You know,
I might, like, but I'm also going to be like, that don't sound like her. Let me find out what she meant.
But if it's something that you heard, something that you two disagree with, or you feel like, yeah, that I know Tiffany did this thing, and I think that thing is wrong.
Give me an example.
Well, I don't do anything wrong, and everything I say is right. So
I don't know. This is true. She doesn't do anything wrong. Never.
I don't know.
I know.
The when I didn't want to show the video to Trump supporters. And you wanted to show the video.
We disagree with that.
But if people are coming up to you like, she get on my nerves. Like, I wanted to see that. Where does she know?
I would be hot. I'd be like, no, she don't get on my nerves. You don't get to say that to me. I'm telling you, I'm not logical.
You can say that, but you can say, I take your point.
No,
you know,
they cannot come to me and tell me that you get on their nerves.
Yeah, that's true.
They don't even know you.
That's true.
No, I'm not ever going to be a receptacle for mess for my friends.
Yeah.
I'm not doing it. Even for people that are associates, I'm not doing it.
Well, then I would say that because that's true.
Because I want people to be that fiercely protective of me.
I was going to say, if somebody came to me like, Angela, get on my nerve, like that would be a challenge for me.
You would say, what you making them?
Okay, Angela's talking about the time that I almost got into a fight. We almost got into a fight
with
somebody.
She was not going to get in a fight. She
would have got into a fight with that man. This man was disrespectful to Angela on the elevator. And I told her if I see him, I was going to say something. But I'm saying...
And she did say something.
And I was ready to throw some knuckles.
You were better on... you were actually better on the...
Because I can't act out the fight.
When you practiced it, I was really nervous.
They didn't believe me, y'all. And I said, if I see him, I'm going
to
say something.
Tiffany need to stay reading books because this is not her ministry.
No. It really isn't my ministry, but I'm willing to fight. I'm willing to fist fight for my friends. So I take your point. But I think for a Jeff Bezos type friendship. Like, yeah. If I come to you and say, Jeff Bezos is on some bullshit, like, and if you're saying to me, that's my friend, and we have a disconnect here. You know?
And you could say that, but I want you to hear why I say that's my friend. And I tell you stuff all the time where you're like, meh, and I'm like, well, let's talk about it. I don't know. I just feel like I hate when people soundbite us. I want to know, like, the full context of what she was going into. And also, like, I'd love to hear the extent of their friendship. Like, how did they become friends? You know, what does it look like? What are your favorite things about this person? Because maybe there's a side of humanity we just don't see.
I don't really care, to be honest. Like, I think if, you know, this person is he's funding a person who's causing harm, he's aligned with people who are causing harm to the greater good, then I don't care what his favorite food is. I don't care how y'all met. I'm looking at you sideways because you are so connected to this person.
You have chosen
this friendship over this wide community of people who upheld you, cheered for you. And it feels like a disconnect because now I'm saying, well, stay with your billionaire friends and stay on that spaceship because I don't know how much space we have for you in community anymore. After you flexed on everybody saying, have you been to space? Number one. And number two, I'm not there yet.
Okay.
But I'm saying if she cannot call out his role in the problem that we're facing here.
But I don't think that's what Gail does. Like, I don't think that...
That's a challenge, too.
Well, okay, but...
In a position of power, what is your point in ascending to this level, hosting a show, and it's not bravery if you don't have fear. Like, of course there's going to be a consequence. That's how you exercise bravery. And so if you are not brave enough to say, hey... You know, this is a problem, or hey, I'm not going to report this like it's okay, or hey, I'm not going to let you sit here and disrespect Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote this brilliant book, who deserves to have his point heard.
I hear that.
Then I got to question you.
I hear that, but also, we have friends in multiple spaces that make decisions about when they're going to challenge things and
when they're not.
That's true. I just am saying, like, I don't know. And for me, I would want the benefit of somebody asking me. And I can say that I have experienced her. We both do United Justice Coalition together. And otherwise, I wouldn't know Gail. Mm-hmm. But that I think that's one of those spaces where it does flatten privilege.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are people like Crystal, you know, who was arrested for trying to exercise her franchise just because she had a record. We have people like the mother of the man who died in Parchman.
Mm-hmm.
And folks like Gail who... will say, I'm reporting on this. I'm going to use my platform to share these stories. You know, like, and when asked, she's like, absolutely. So it's hard for me because I don't expect her to show up like me.
Mm-hmm.
I do expect her to show up. And I can say in that space, at least 9 times out of 10, maybe 10 out of 10, she's showing up.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean,
people are multidimensional.
I have not been to space.
I still have an issue.
I don't think I want to go on one of them ships neither, though. I want to go.
I'm not going on Jeff Bezos, nothing. My issue is the way this conversation started is about us and wealth,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how we can change when we have wealth and can we stay connected to community?
We have to.
I've seen a lot of people with money get disconnected from community.
That's what
and
I was saying. I don't think it's just
one.
Money, though. I think you could move out of your neighborhood and get disconnected. I think you could
get old and get disconnected. I said on the podcast this week, I don't know who 19 Keys is. I feel so disconnected from people.
But
I can't
name
there,
the like there is
red
something
song.
Even about our elders. You can't move around the way that you used to be able to move around and you get disconnected. So sometimes it's not even intentional.
Yeah.
It's you are a product of your circumstance.
Yeah.
So I do think I like this, the idea of intentional, meaningful connection. I think that helps us live in grace, embody grace, and maybe patience with each other. And maybe it gives us space to confront somebody too if you know, what they're doing is off. But I think that my weakness is, man, I hate when I get misunderstood somewhere online or on from some media clip or whatever. I'm like, well, what's behind that?
Well, she wasn't misunderstood. I mean, as you know, I will listen and I'm a reader. She was not misunderstood. I mean,
but I'm saying maybe she doubled down in something that was nonsense in that moment, but that's not the totality of who she is. Like, I don't want people to judge me off of Snoop. Or you know what comes up all the time? There's a moment where me and Leonard were talking about Louis Farrakhan on a podcast. I was frustrated at the time about what I was hearing him say that felt anti-Semitic. It was one clip. I don't think he's an anti-Semite.
I don't think so.
I don't. I actually summarily reject it when I hear it every time. But it came up, and the minister actually ended up reaching out. Mm-hmm. He was like, you know, young sister, I just want to talk to you. And I was like, I hope you know that that's not what I think. Now people quote it and say that I called him dumb and like crazy stuff that I've never said. And it's frustrating because this is a man that I grew up looking up to.
Yeah.
When my dad went to the Million Man March, I got to stay home and watch the Million Man March. Yeah. So I would never, you know?
Well, I think there the masses can do that. There are a lot of people out there. I am basing this on, we're in the same industry, years of watching Gail. Being in the same spaces with her, I feel like you and me together have probably been in the same spaces with her. I've had conversations with Gail before. Based on everything that one of my friends is her executive producer. I won't say her name. She might have to disassociate from me now after I said this.
Well, now you just named her.
I know. But my point is that I'm not basing this on a clipped bite. I would never, you know, like I am fully aware of some things that she's done and said in their totality, and space just being the latest. I was disappointed, as you know, in how that Ta-Nehisi Coates interview went down.
I was too.
Yeah.
I was too.
So it's a collection of things, but not to just pick on Gail. And I also defended Gail after she asked what I thought to be an inappropriate question of Lisa Leslie after Kobe's death. And people pounced on her and called her out of her name. I was on Joy Reid's show and defended her because I thought the question was out of pocket and not done in journalistic integrity. But people disrespecting her and calling her a bitch and like all these things, we don't have to do that. So I don't want to just pick on Gail, but I do think her remarks were incredibly tone deaf and very disrespectful to a lot of people who are going through a lot of challenges right now because of this administration. And she is publicly praising someone who was very much aligned with this administration and considers him a friend, considers his wife a friend. And just, it felt disconnected and it felt disrespectful. And one of the chief reasons why Gail is who she is because of the support of Black women. And so when Black women are calling you out and tapping you on your shoulder, I think it's enough for you to listen and just check yourself.
Maybe she is.
I hope so. Yeah. Maybe she'll come out and say something about it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there is something about wealth and us. And I just wonder, you know, when they get wealth is different. When we get wealth, I think it comes with obligation and responsibility.
I agree.
Yeah.
We all know. Like members of Congress, some of those members of Congress are making the most money they've ever made in their lives and taking care of a whole bunch of people. Yeah. And that is on the low end. But still, it would probably be the top 10% of income earners in the country.
Yeah, especially among Black folks.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So, well, anyway, if you all know a way that we can do a social experiment and Angela and I can get wealth, let us know because we are willing to.
Tiffany wants to trade Forex.
What's Forex?
Some nonsense. My brother does that.
See, I'm disconnected. This could be some popular thing.
You should
thing
stay
that
disconnected
know about.
From that.
I don't know
anything
about it.
In the name of Jesus, stay disconnected from that.
Remember, I don't know anything about it. But what I appreciate about today,
I got Bitcoins.
I have some.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
I got some.
Years ago.
Years ago. Are you rich on that?
No.
Do you look on them?
I have somebody overlooking my
entire financial. How much you got
in there? $1,500.
Oh, that's pretty good. That's more than me.
I don't know if I can say the company, but.
Don't say it. Yeah.
I that's what I have now. I don't remember how much I put in. It wasn't a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I have $1,500 now.
$1,500.
So I think if I put in $1,500, how much would I have now? Had I put in $20,000, how much would I have now? You know? But
I put in $100.
How much you have now?
Let's look.
Yeah. While she's looking for that, pull it up because I want to know. While she's looking for that, what I will say I appreciate about this conversation is the challenge for people to extend grace.
I know, Mom. I'm really lucky you gave me a head start with Self.
Yeah, well, I didn't have a safety net back then. But with Self, you've been able to build your credit and savings each month.
And to make sure that you understand what someone's saying. And
I can't remember the app that I started doing. Is it called Bitcoin? Bitcoin.
Challenge you to make sure that you understand the totality of someone's statements, not in clipped Instagram.
Coinbase. Bites,
but, oh, yeah. But just understand the full context of what someone is saying before posting.
I got a new phone. It's logged out.
Oh, God. We don't know how much Angela made.
I'm going to tell y'all next time.
Yeah. Stay tuned to see how much wealth we've built in a week when we're back here. Anyway, you got anything else to say to the people before we go?
Yeah, I'm mad I locked down my Coinbase. I was looking forward to reporting back if my $20 grew.
So they got to tune in. It's just one of those 1980s to be continued.
You know I'm not
remember. But people don't know about that to be continued. Man. You know, now you get to binge watch 12 episodes. But in the 80s when the show went off and it was to be continued, baby.
When they played that music?
Yes.
That would be a cold game.
You
when they
could not
them.
Wait. It's wait, like, woo, Family Ties is a two-parter. I know what I'm doing with my
Sha-la-la.
Time. Oh, we old. Anyway. Thanks for tuning in to this mini podcast.
What would we do, baby,
without love? Sha-la-la-la.
And there ain't no nothing we can't love each other
through. What do we do, baby?
Oh, I got in my Bitcoin.
Okay. This ain't the to be continued then. What's your Bitcoin?
Okay. Here you go.
That's a drum
device
roll.
Not recognized.
Okay.
It's a two-parter.
All right. Never mind. To be continued. Sha-la-la-la.
Sha-la-la-la. That's how we should end the episode now. Forget welcome home. Sha-la-la-la.
Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
We didn't talk about Carmelo Anthony and what happened because I'm waiting a beat. Like there's some stories going on that I want to wait to see all of the information. It, and people are using these moments to divide and to build platforms because this is the world that we're in. Everyone, as Dr. Story said, wants to jump in front of a camera, jump in front of these stories so they can gain influencer, you know, the numbers so that they can make money. But this is not the time. So they had a White Lives Matter rally this weekend to, you know, because they're saying, you know, this country is, you know, under siege by these black criminals and white people are in jeopardy. And Austin Metcalf was killed by a, you know, a raging, violent black boy who now we know Carmelo Anthony is nothing that they said he was. And what's even worse, Omi, is that Austin Metcalf's dad is not with it. So a black man showed up to the rally with Austin Metcalf's dad on the phone. With the cameras, you know, because they had the cameras and everything.
Yeah,
I'm gonna play the clip. You need to hear this. You need to hear this. Okay. Play the clip, Smith. Metcalf's dad. This is wild. So the first voice you hear, I think, is gonna be a black man confronting the guy that started the White Lives Matter rally. Okay, so he's confronting him. Play it, Smith.
Fathers who are not dealing with grief. You've talked for an hour. So if you want to address, I can give you after I give this message. The bottom line is this: you have a father that's out of respect asking you not to put his son's face in a place. How do you say you're going to represent people when you can't respect the will of the people?
His father's not asking.
Let me respond, guys. There's too much peanut gallery.
That's not what his father said. His father did not say that.
Can we please let me respond?
So you believe. No, listen.
Hey, you believe.
I'm having a conversation between you and I.
The vast majority still of people who can make a difference in this country in affecting American policy towards Palestine, the vast majority of the people are still holding on to the myth that we will try to debunk and challenge today. You can see that the mythologies that informed the conversation in this country about the future of Israel in Palestine is still the very same conversation, as if the last 9 or 10 months have taught these people nothing about what is wrong with their attitude and their analysis.
That's Ilan Pape, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Ilan Pape on Myths of Israel. A myth is a story passed down through generations that attempts to explain the origins of something. The foundational myth of Israel is a land without people for a people without a land. That myth had profound consequences that reverberate today. There were people there, the Palestinians. Such myths are characteristic of settler colonial societies such as South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States. Sure, there were a few primitive savages, but they had to give way to superior beings. John Kennedy famously said, quote, "We stand today on the edge of a new frontier. The pioneers gave up their safety, their comfort, and sometimes their lives to build our new West." Kennedy did not mention the great indigenous nations that were slaughtered by the colonizers. We must deconstruct the myths and reveal the realities behind them. Our guest today is Ilan Pappe. He's been called Israel's bravest historian. He taught at the University of Haifa and was chair of the Tuma Institute for Palestinian and Israeli Studies in Haifa. Currently, he's professor of history at the University of Exeter in England. He's the author of many books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, Gaza in Crisis, 10 Myths About Israel, and Lobbying for Zionism. During the course of his presentation, he mentions that he was detained and questioned for 2 hours by federal agents at the Detroit airport when he came to the United States. He was asked before being released about his views on Hamas, Gaza, genocide, and Israel. He spoke at the Socialism 2024 conference in Chicago on August 31st. And now, Ilan Pappe, Myths of Israel.
Thank you all for being here. It feels a bit surreal to talk about history at a time when we are all gathered here to think together how to stop the genocide in Gaza and the one that is developing in the West Bank, and how to strategize or help to strategize for the liberation of Palestine. But as I think many of you are aware, the history of the Zionist project in Palestine is a very important entry point for understanding the situation today and for discussing the future. And once we are thinking of extending the network of support for Palestine beyond our usual suspects, beyond the people we have worked for so many years together in the solidarity movement, we still, I'm sure, are aware, about the level of ignorance and misinformation and mythologies that are connected to the way the mainstream media in this country and in the global north in general reports the history of Palestine, the situation in Palestine, and as well as in some very important academic centers, still in courses and modules across the academia in the global north, still the way the history is being told plays an important role in the immunity that Israel is granted by the global north, and particularly by the United States, for its criminal policies on the ground. And it's not enough to defy or even defeat the misinformation and fabrication that goes along with the historical narrative that are being spent in, by the media or by the academia by sound bites. The machinery that produces these misinformed, misguided, and fabricated narratives is a very sophisticated one and includes a lot of important academics and journalists and wordsmiths, people who know how to write and how to talk and how to preach. In order to challenge them successfully, we need to understand the history of the place of the Zionist movement, of the Zionist project, in a profound way through proper research, through professional historiography, and with the help of those who decided to devote their life for that kind of research and activity. So I think that their interaction, which was always very important in the left, between academics or intellectuals, educators, and activists, is something which is highly important for the success of expanding the network of solidarity with Palestine and contributing, be it a modest contribution to the liberation of Palestine and the decolonization of historical Palestine. The 10 Myths of Israel, the book itself, was actually born out of this rather frustrating engagement I had, not with people in the solidarity movement with Palestine, but whenever I try to expand my dialogue beyond those who are committed or have been committed strongly to Palestine. Whenever you try to expand the network, to try and say, I will talk with some people who seem to be reasonable, educated, have a modicum of decency in them, whose positions on other social and political issues you respect. In fact, some of them are your mentors in certain areas of study or human activity. You encounter this very solid narrative of why there is a conflict in Palestine, what is its origins, why is it continuing, and what is the best way to deal with it. And you understand that even if you had 50 minutes to talk with these people, if they would be patient enough to listen to you, even that would not be enough. That actually only if you can somehow convince them to sit in your class for a whole year, as I suggested, the two agents of the Homeland Security in Detroit, when they kept teaching me the history of Palestine, I thought that only a year with them, I mean, with these two guys, I probably needed 2 years. You really need a year at least to unpack and challenge the kind of history that maybe for some of you would sound bizarre, but the vast majority still of people who can make a difference in this country in affecting American policy towards Palestine are still holding on to the myth that we will try to debunk and challenge. We can divide these mythologies or myths to ones that come from the past, even the distant past, some that are still with us and relate to a more kind of contemporary issues or the present, if you want, and some that are associated with the way people who are in a position to influence policies are talking about the future. And some of these myths about how to engage in a conversation about the future of Palestine have unfortunately emerged in the last year, put forward by the professional side of the Biden administration, when they come under the title of the day after. And the day after, the way it is being articulated, not just by the politicians, by the president, the vice president, or the secretary of state, but if you read more into the kind of more professional policy papers that have been prepared under the title of the day after, mainly for Gaza, but not only for Gaza, for the whole issue of Palestine, you can see that the mythologies that informed the conversation in this country about the future of Israel in Palestine is still the very same conversation, as if the last 9 or 10 months have taught these people nothing about what is wrong with their attitude and their analysis. So the first, probably, and you're familiar, a myth that for many of us would sound maybe ridiculous or obnoxious or unrealistic or untrue or invalid, is still one that you can hear a lot of people repeating in one version or the other. And that's the myth that Palestine was a land without people, waiting for the people without land. And what is important in challenging the first part of this myth that Palestine was a land without people is that you don't do it by saying, no, it was. Thank God, for the last 20 or 25 years, very erudite industrious historians have managed to reconstruct for us the history of Palestine on the eve of the Zionist arrival. And Palestine before the arrival of the Zionists, the early Zionists arrived in Palestine in 1882. Palestine on the eve of the arrival of the Zionists was a place with a vibrant society where people were mostly living in rural areas, but also had some urban centers, which were were organically connected to the rest of the region, which in Arabic was called the Mashrik, that is the Eastern Mediterranean. And the flow of ideas, of culture production, of ideas and platforms included very much Jaffa and Haifa and Jerusalem, as it did Beirut, Damascus, Alexandria, or Cairo. All these cities were interconnected organically in cultural, economic, and social ties. And that's why Palestine was such a vibrant place. The period, and I think some of you know that, in the history of that part of the world, the period that precedes the arrival of the Zionists, namely more or less 1800 to 1882, is called the period of the Renaissance, al-Nahda in Arabic. The Renaissance of which meant, as in anywhere else in the world, when we talk about Renaissance, that is where new ideas are flowing, where people are producing through plays, through fiction, through journalism, and any other kind of cultural media, new works, new interpretation of the reality. And in that particular age, the age of nationalism, it also helps to gel a collective identity receiving new ideas such as self-determination, liberation, and independence as part of the overall perception of who you are, where you came from, and where you're going. And this society was on the way, like the other societies around it, on the way towards a challenge period where European imperialism began to replace the Ottoman Empire that ruled that area for 400 years. But with European imperialism came also the good contributions of Europe to that area, as well as the more negative ones. And it's very, very clear, although we are not allowed to write a book in history which says what would have happened if, we always tell our students, don't do that. But actually, we should tell our students to do that, because it's very good for one's imagination and understanding alternative developments in history. But it's very clear that without Zionism, there's no reason to believe that Palestine would have not developed like the countries around it, with the same problems and same achievements. And maybe we always like to believe, maybe it would have done even better than its neighbors, given what we think, and I'm totally subjective here, about the quality of the people who lived between the river and the sea on the eve of the arrival of the Zionists. But definitely, this was not an empty land in terms of society, culture, and society, and people. And it's important to stress this point, because I think for quite a lot of liberals around the world, this idea that actually the Jews colonized, or a group of Jews colonized, an empty place makes it easier to defeat any notions that would equate Zionism with colonialism. Because if you colonize an empty space, then it's not really colonialism, it's just a movement into an empty land. But it was not. And as we know, many settler colonial movements treated lands with indigenous people as empty land. The Zionists have not invented anything new. In fact, they were inspired by those who already preceded them with the same notion that where you have indigenous people, the land is empty. The fact that, for example, Cambridge University, I'm sorry, it's Oxford University Press, still produces an atlas of the Arab-Israeli conflict by Martin Gilbert, in I think it's the 15th edition or something like that. And it has a cartographic history of Palestine, namely the history of Palestine through maps. And the first map is, of course, Palestine in the biblical times. And then you have Palestine during the Roman times. And then nothing really happens in Palestine until the Crusaders come. And between the Crusaders and the arrival of Zionism, again, there's a black hole. Nothing happened. And this is one of the most important tools for teaching, especially young people, the history of Palestine, a space that was not a place, a space where nothing happened until the Zionists arrived. And again, comparable to the way some atlases are telling the history of Australia, Americas, and so on. As for the myths of the Zionist movement representing people without land, well, this notion that people of the Jewish faith were a nation and therefore entitled to a nation state, and that nation state had to be the ancient biblical land of Palestine, has been also contested very successfully by professional historians. There is no doubt that there were Jews in the late 19th century who decided to redefine Judaism as nationalism. That's an historical fact. But that doesn't mean that this is something that, A, most of the Jews at the time accepted. In fact, not. It was a minority position. And it was transformed into a powerful movement, not because a lot of Jews were recruited behind the idea that Judaism is actually not a religion, but nationalism. They were recruited actually by a lot of, by two groups, I would say, who were, I call them selective anti-Semites, and I'll explain what I mean by that. One group, which is still very important today in sustaining Zionist mythologies, are the Christian fundamentalists, a very important stream in evangelical Christianity that long before any Jew thought about Zionism were already the early Zionists, dating back to the 17th century and 18th century. Why do I call them selective anti-Semites? Because they developed a dogma, which I think some of you are familiar with, the restorationist dogma, which believed that the return of the Jews, so to speak, to the Holy Land, namely to Palestine, would precipitate the second coming of the Messiah, the resurrection of the dead, and the beginning of the 1,000 years of Christ's rule on the globe. Now, why was it selective anti-Semitic? Because, in a way, what motivated the less pious members of this movement, what really attracted them to the idea, was that was a way, if you want, an elegant way of getting rid of the Jews and getting back the only Jew you really wanted, Jesus Christ. It's a double bill for a fanatic Christian fundamentalist. Couldn't be better. And they were very, very active on both sides of the Atlantic in pushing Jewish intellectuals to stand behind the idea that not only Judaism is nationalism, but it had to be fulfilled in Palestine. Even the founding father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, was not entirely sure that Palestine was the only possible destination for modernizing the Jews as a nation instead of a faith. He was willing to consider Uganda, for instance, when the British offered that, and some of his colleagues were even touring places here in the United States and in South America, in Azerbaijan, looking for places where maybe Zionism could be fulfilled. But in order to make sure that the new Jewish movement does not give up on the idea of Palestine as an exclusive destination for implementing Zionism as nationalism, the Christian Zionists were very important in pressuring the Zionist movement not to change course and to hone on Palestine as the main destination. And these Christian Zionists